From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. The abortion map in this country is changing quickly following the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Mississippi's lone abortion clinic plans to close today following a state legal battle. And in Iowa, courts are wrestling over a proposed 24-hour waiting period for procedures. A lot in flux. So let's check the map with Sarah McCammon. She covers abortion politics and policy for NPR. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
So on the day the Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right to an abortion, 8 states banned them. Another 5 have what are called trigger bans taking effect soon. How many people live in states where abortion is now illegal?
Well, this number is constantly in flux, and it depends on what the courts say on any given day. I mean, there are, first of all, several different types of laws. You mentioned trigger laws, which were written specifically to go into effect after Roe was overturned. And as you said, multiple states tried to enforce those right away. Then there are pre-Roe v. Wade laws. Texas had one of those that the attorney general was trying to enforce, prohibiting abortion. And then there are others that were just too restrictive with Roe in effect, and many states are trying to implement those too. So the answer to that question shifts, but the bottom line is that about half the country has some type of restrictive abortion law on the books, and you know, there are hearings underway. There will be one in Kentucky today and in Louisiana on Friday, surrounding some of the litigation around these laws. So just a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, and as I hear you describing, no easy answer to some of these questions. There is confusion, I gather, in states that have bans, but they don't go into effect right away. So in those states, what is the practical effect on providers and pregnant people seeking abortions?
Well, I'm not seeing any reports of, you know, for people living in states without restrictions being prevented from getting abortions at this time.
Okay.
For those that go into effect in a couple of weeks, I think we'll have another wave of some of this kind of confusion. But you talk about uncertainty on the ground, and there is a lot of that. I mean, for example, in Montana, Planned Parenthood just said in the last few days that they would stop providing abortion pills to patients from South Dakota and other states with abortion bans. The concern being that people might take those pills at home and potentially violate those state laws. Montana says they're still providing surgical abortions to people from out of state there in Montana, but again, not giving out abortion pills. So yes, I mean, there is, I can't say it enough, tremendous uncertainty about interstate issues, and also many states have multiple abortion restrictions on the books. That's an issue in Louisiana as well as Texas that's been litigated. And so attorneys tell me it's unclear in some cases which laws are in effect right now.
And I just heard you say is it Montana, at least one state, there are abortion pills that are not being dispensed. So this is procedures as well as pills we're talking about.
Right. For some patients, for patients from certain states, that's true.
Okay. And I've seen some of the maps on the penalties on the books for the provider, some of them multiple years in prison, tens of thousands of dollars, perhaps, if they're found in violation of this. Now, conversely, some states have laws explicitly enshrining abortion rights. Geographically, where are those?
They're kind of where you would expect, you know, California and New York, for example, are some of those states. And then there are states like Illinois in the middle of the country that are becoming what abortion rights supporters call a haven for abortion care. Also, several states, Scott, have taken steps in recent years to expand abortion access or protect it with an eye toward the possibility of Roe v. Wade being overturned. Just this year, lawmakers in New Jersey and Colorado, for example, put explicit protections in their state law. Maryland is allowing a broader range of healthcare providers to perform abortions now. So there is really a push-pull, and we use the word patchwork a lot. It's a very patchwork system at this time and likely will be for quite some time.
Yeah. And in a few states, at least 3 states, I gather, abortion bans have been blocked. They're still in the courts, Kentucky, Louisiana, and Utah. So what's happening there? I mean, in the courtrooms and on the ground?
Right. I mentioned the litigation surrounding some of these state abortion bans and the confusion about which ones are in effect. So far, reproductive rights lawyers have had at least some temporary success in the states you mentioned, Kentucky, Louisiana, and Utah, in allowing abortions to resume. But that could very quickly change. You know, as I said, there are legal battles underway, and things can change kind of from moment to moment. But in general, that is the strategy. It's to challenge some of these abortion bans under state law, since the U.S. Supreme Court has said, the Constitution does not provide a right to an abortion. So lawyers are arguing that state constitutions in some cases may include protections for abortion rights.
Okay. And briefly, this patchwork you're talking about, you know, means some people will cross state lines to receive abortion services. You talked to Peter Breen of the conservative Thomas More Society. Let's take a listen.
If you have a fund that is aiming to bring people from a pro-life state to an abortion state in order to abort an unborn resident of the pro-life state, that state is going to have something to say about it.
Just quickly, Sarah, what is he saying here?
Well, the number one way that they're trying to do that is through civil litigation, using civil lawsuits to prevent people from providing abortions or helping people get them. And that is a big part of the strategy going forward for abortion rights opponents.
NPR's Sarah McCammon, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to foster care, created as a safety net when parents are deemed not able to care for their kids. In 2018, Congress set out to give those parents services to build up their ability to bring kids home. But there's another policy, left over from more punitive times, that gets in the way. And now, after an NPR investigation, federal officials are changing it. NPR's Joseph Shapiro explains.
The law that gets in the way is from 1984. It said states and counties are required to send parents whose kids go into foster care a bill to share the cost for their child's foster care. The problem, though, is that these mothers and fathers are almost always poor. They don't have the money to pay the bills, which are often hundreds of dollars a month. Parents like Bree.
Me and my family were living in a travel trailer.
A camper they towed behind their old pickup truck. They moved into a trailer park midway between Tacoma and Seattle.
Obviously, we were low income. We were trying to get our wages up.
Then, in 2019, her husband was charged with assaulting their son, a charge Bree, we agreed to use just her first name, and her husband disputed. The boy, who was almost four, was placed into foster care. Eventually, all the charges against the husband were dismissed. It took 13 months to get their son back home. The state of Washington billed them $8,000 to pay for the boy's foster care and garnished Bree's paycheck $1,400 a month.
I'm out of my mind because I see my check and I'm like, oh my God, how do I pay my bills?
In every state, parents get charged for the cost of foster care, even though, as an NPR investigation last year found, it hurts children and their parents because it keeps families in debt and it extends by several months the time children spend in foster care. A mom who has to pay the cost of her kid's foster care might not have enough money left over to, say, rent a bigger apartment, which a court might require before she can bring her kids home. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services responded to our reporting. In June, the Children's Bureau, that's the federal agency in charge of policy on adoption and foster care, issued new guidance. It allows states and counties, if they want, to stop charging those parents.
We were elated. We were relieved. We were very excited as a state agency to see the updated federal guidance.
That's Allison Krutzinger from Washington State's Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Earlier this year, her department wanted to stop charging parents, but the federal government said no. The new rules say they can, after all. And Krutzinger says that will help troubled families get stronger.
What this means for families is that it's one less potential economic hardship as they are working to get their family back.
In our investigation, we found it's people of color who, in disproportionate numbers, get charged with these bills for foster care. Bree has a black parent and a white parent. One day in court, Bree told the judge that the bill for foster care was too high.
I told the judge this. I said, look, we came from poverty. We're barely getting out of it, and we're paying off of all of our debts so that we can actually have proper housing for our son. And you're putting us back into poverty.
The judge reduced the monthly payment, but the $8,000 debt remained and kept coming out of their paychecks. Today, things are going better. The family moved out of that travel trailer, and with a government rent subsidy, they live in a house now. But Bree still owes a few hundred dollars to pay off that foster care. That new policy in Washington state to stop charging parents will only apply to parents coming into the system now. It won't help Bree and others who still owe money. Jill Durbarek, a professor of social welfare at the University of California at Berkeley, says the new federal guidance is a start.
And with the new rules, we're going to see a checkerboard where we will have some states that are more generous and some states that are not generous. And that's the American way. Location, location, location.
But it will take an act of Congress to end, for good, the practice of sending impoverished parents a bill for the cost of foster care. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
The Supreme Court decision turning abortion regulation back to the states and effectively overturning Roe v. Wade has raised so many questions. What happens to abortion pills, which can end a pregnancy in the first 11 weeks without a surgical procedure? And what about legal surgical procedures used in abortions after 11 weeks that remove matter related to the pregnancy? It's the same procedure, called a DNC, used after miscarriages that don't fully expel all the tissue. Removing that tissue is important because leaving any behind after a miscarriage can cause infections. But will doctors have to prove that it was a miscarriage and not an abortion? And what if a DNC is an abortion, a choice, because the fetus isn't viable? That's what happened to our next guest. Her post to her friends and family on Facebook caught our eye. "It's been 6 weeks and 2 days since we lost our little girl," she wrote. "There's not one story of what abortion is. I am angry and heartbroken and sobbing as I write this. I am mad at the liberals in the clinic who thought this procedure would be liberating. I am mad at the conservatives who might assume I wasn't responsible. We wanted this baby." The post was written by 38-year-old Sarah, who did legally terminate that pregnancy. We're not using her last name because she fears retribution from people who disagree with her. But she has a story to tell. And a warning, it's a very tender one, maybe not for young ears. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you for having me and letting me share my story.
Sure. And as we do that, you know, as you say, this is not something you wanted to do. You wanted to have that baby. You have a beautiful, healthy toddler. This is, you know, a loss, as it is for so many women. So we're so sorry.
So, Robin, it's been 7 weeks since we lost our child. Mm. And I cannot tell you how anxious we were to be pregnant. And I probably took about 20 pregnancy tests in just a few months, checking, you know, every couple days around my period. And so...
Well, you know, 7 weeks is nothing. There are women who, decades later, weep over an abortion that they felt was still the right thing to do. Tell us what happened.
So I'm 38. So even with our first child, it was still considered a pregnancy of advanced maternal age. So that means higher risks. So for our first baby that we had when I was 36, we decided to take a genetic prenatal screening test that checks for common chromosomal conditions that might affect our baby's health. We wanted to be prepared to know what choices we had for whatever the test might show. And the soonest you can take that test is at 10 weeks. So when I took that test with our first child, I was made to watch a fairly lengthy and descriptive video outlining all the things that might be different about our child. And it tests from everything from Down syndrome to spina bifida, where the child can be born without a brain. And so the idea of that video is to make sure you understand the range of chromosomal conditions that widely affect how your baby lives or doesn't. And so I cried all the way through the video and all the way home from the test, just because of the extreme weight of responsibility of this knowledge that this test would give us.
Yeah.
And so our first baby screening was fine. We had a healthy little boy in 2020. But when this pregnancy had a red flag on the screening, our doctor called me and told me to come into that office the same day to talk it over. So my husband and I went to the doctor for an ultrasound a few hours later, then 11 weeks pregnant. Robin could hardly walk into that office.
Yeah.
I collapsed outside the door before we could even go in and hear what that doctor had to say. But it turns out that our baby tested positive for trisomy 13. It's a condition that she could not survive. Mm. And so further tests confirmed that her heart was malformed, the spine, as well as the brain. And in that same ultrasound, we could see the baby had 6 fingers on one hand. So most babies with trisomy 13 are miscarried or stillborn, and the few that survive die within their first days or weeks of life. So we wanted this baby. We wanted our baby to be okay, but she wasn't.
Yeah.
And we wanted our little girl. The same test that told us she wouldn't survive told us she was a little girl. And so most of all, we wanted our little girl not to suffer, no matter how much that meant that we would suffer having the burden of making the choice for how she lived. So how do you make the choice to end a pregnancy? It's so complicated. An early abortion means that our baby would suffer the least, unlikely to feel pain or be aware. Our baby might have suffered in my womb if she kept growing. And while this baby most likely would have miscarried, we live about 24 hours away from good hospital care. A miscarriage would have been dangerous for me. And finally, with the baby being less than 3 months long, at that point, we mourn the idea of our little girl more than the actual presence of a full-term baby, which would have been an entirely different kind of loss.
Well, and what's really striking me, as you're killing me here, you and your husband were going to suffer, did suffer through this procedure, but you felt that it was better for her, that she would suffer less.
Yeah. Yeah. I do believe God gave women the joy, the responsibility, and the burden of childbirth. And maybe God knew that as mothers, we would make any sacrifice we have to for our children. I will suffer the trauma of an abortion the rest of my life. But I would do it again if it meant that my baby will not suffer a single day. So we actually chose to go to California because we thought it would be easier there. My parents live there. We live in a place where abortion is not accepted, hard to access. So we decided to fly to California. Because where do you go? Like, do you know? Yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah.
I first called Planned Parenthood, but the wait for an abortion was 3 weeks, and we couldn't wait that long.
Yeah.
Not only was it difficult to get an appointment or find out who to talk to, like I ended up talking to one clinic that falsely advertised that they had choices.
Was that one of the birth centers that actually is a place where people try to talk people out of abortions?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just a mess. And so we finally got an appointment at a women's clinic, and it was a week later before we could get in. The clinic, you know, called to remind me how to prepare, eat well. By the way, your husband can't accompany you inside the clinic. COVID measures. Ugh. So, like, here we are in California, again, where it's legal, where it should be, where a lot of people accept it. What's wrong?
Yeah.
He waited in the parking lot. Like, the people at the clinic were very nice, but even they didn't get my story. And that's what's so frustrating in all of this, of whether it should be legal or not. The only reason I came out on Facebook is because apparently this is not a private issue. Because the Supreme Court is mandating it, that it become a public thing, that it become out of my hands. And it's not the choice between my husband and I. And even at the clinic where they would support abortion, there was still a single story idea that my abortion might liberate me or give me back part of my life, where in reality, I was losing part of it right, by losing this child.
Let's talk about that, because you weren't feeling that they understood that you can both make the choice and have pain about it.
Right. Many of them had had abortions themselves, and I hope that is a liberating thing for many women, as it should be. But it wasn't our story.
Yeah.
We didn't get to say goodbye.
Yeah.
They even assigned me someone to hold my hand during the procedure, but instead I gripped her entire body to mine.
Yeah.
Because an abortion, Robin, if it was illegal, then a lot of women wouldn't get to take that pill. They'd have to have the procedure like we did. It was 15 minutes, and it was a vacuum, Robin.
Yeah.
It was horrible. I am pro-choice, but no one is pro-abortion. We're going to have a lot more women doing a lot more desperate things, and even when it is legal in California, the procedure was still horrible.
Yeah. Well, what has been the response from your family?
Both of our sets of parents were very supportive. We're very grateful to them, as well as the friends and other family members that reached out. And maybe our parents wouldn't have considered themselves pro-choice beforehand. The hardest part is having an abortion at the same time that this giant political debate is happening, with people screaming at each other on Facebook. Friends and acquaintances I have on Facebook that are anti-abortion and all the reasons they think it's wrong, and not knowing how to address them.
Yeah. Well, when you say not knowing how to address them, you just did. And eloquently. That's Sarah, who terminated her wanted pregnancy after finding out that the baby she carried suffered from a medical condition that would result in a stillbirth or death before or after delivery. Sarah, thank you so much. We're sorry for your loss. And thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Robin.
The staff is in hybrid mode. Some of us go in, some of us stay home. This week, I'm in the NPR building in D.C., so it's either metro or slow-rolling bicycle for me. But the trains in this town are not full the way they once were, so transit systems in much of the country are hurting, just as federal money is ending, which means D.C., Boston, Los Angeles face financial cliffs in the next year, according to the group Transit Center. Let's talk now to Here and Now's transportation analyst, Seth Kaplan, about this. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Scott. Yeah, someone who used to take metro to that building where you are for every one of these segments, and now...
Right. Well, maybe you're part of the problem. I mean, deficits of $500 million in D.C., more than $230 million in Boston. Is this largely a work-from-home story?
Largely, yes. There are different reasons why different systems are in bad shape, but the proximate cause is just lower ridership. And generally speaking, the agencies that relied the most on people who are what some folks in the transit business call transit optional, right? People who can make choices about how to get around and who now are often not going to the office at all, are the ones who are suffering the most. There are exceptions. Los Angeles is one that, according to Governing Magazine, citing a organization called Transit Center, faces a fiscal cliff, even though it has recovered more of its ridership than other systems.
So this fiscal cliff, as I read, I think maybe a couple of the same articles, they come in the next year or so. DC ridership is only about halfway back, Boston 60% or so. So without that revenue coming in, and eventually when the federal money runs out, what are these cities going to do? Are they going to charge more? We're all already contending with high gas prices.
Right. And in fact, some have done exactly the opposite. DC, which you mentioned, one of the systems that's in the worst shape, has been looking at cutting fares, especially off-peak fares, times when they figure maybe it can lure some additional people on, you know, $2 flat fares late at night, that sort of thing. And so the calculation is, you know, is that just additional revenue, even though the fares are lower if you're getting new people on? On the other hand, yeah, if you're cutting fares for people who are riding anyway, that's revenue negative. But they're very leery about raising fares at a time when revenue has been down, because that could just put you into what they consider a death spiral, right? You raise fares and then even fewer people ride.
Oh, yeah.
Tough questions. Yeah.
Well, I imagine for some cities or states, there's new infrastructure law money that they might be able to tap into. But long term, Seth, I mean, some ridership may never come back, right? I mean, we think of these public services as things the free market doesn't necessarily provide.
Right. And important to remember that highways also are subsidized, right? They're not a free market success story either.
Yeah, yeah.
General fund dollars, you know, goes into that. So it's all a question of policy priorities. But no, you're right. Even the systems that have recovered the most, and they tend to be in smaller cities where maybe a greater percentage of riders are not those transit optional, but what you call sometimes the transit dependent people who might not own cars, might have to go to jobs where working from home isn't an option. Even those systems are lucky to be back to 70 or 80% for systems that in many cases still have all the costs they used to have, but not all the revenue. And so they're going to have to be nimble and figure out ways to lure people on. Bus rapid transit systems in a place like Richmond is one that's been a good story. Those are the kinds of projects that systems are looking at to lure more riders.
Yeah. Figure it out, as you say. Here Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thank you.
Scott, thank you.
And now a moment to consider summer reading for kids. Now, we're not talking YA or young adult fiction. Teens usually want to pick out their own thing. But what's a book for a 12-year-old or younger? Maybe something you could read with them. Let's ask Juanita Giles. She has a list. She's the executive director of the Virginia Children's Book Festival. She joins us now. Juanita, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Before we get to your list, which is so much fun, for parents thinking, I have yet to get my younger child to read, how do you do that?
Well, the quickest way to do it is to read with your child. Mm-hmm. That is something that I stand behind. And also, I would encourage parents and caregivers to read books themselves and have children see them reading. That is also extraordinarily important.
Okay, so here are some on your list that you can read or look at with your child, because we've got a couple of picture books, very young readers. One you wanted to share, I just love even the title, which we have to decide how we're pronouncing it. I Want to Be a Vase or Vase.
Yes. So I love this book so much. And I'll say I Want to Be a Vase. Let's just say
okay.
Vase by Julio Torres. And it's about a plunger who doesn't want to be a plunger. He doesn't want to be in the bathroom next to the toilet. He wants to be a beautiful vase with lovely smells and beautiful flowers. And it's all about this poor plunger's quest to become something other than he is. Kids will laugh. Parents will laugh. It's just the most fun.
Well, you've combined so many things there for a small child. Anything that where they get to say toilet.
Exactly.
Toilet plunger, you know, and the fact that there's a superhero and it happens to be a toilet plunger, so they get to make poop jokes and stuff. So that's great. Another one, The Wills and the Won'ts. This is Angela Wolfe, a couple of neighbors who can't get along, so they decide to build a wall. How timely.
Exactly. And also, may I say, timely and yet in the greatest tradition of read aloud books. It rhymes, it's funny, and it's about two neighbors who decide that they can't get along. And so what they do is they build walls to keep each other away. And there's a little girl named May who takes it upon herself to take down this wall. And it turns out that the Wills and the Won'ts become coulds or maybes, and it is such a wonderful, wonderful book, and the illustrations are so much fun as well.
We'll move to older readers. One of your recommendations, a great way to get kids outside, which we don't think of when we think of books, it's Rosemary Mosco's Expedition Backyard.
Well, this is actually a nonfiction chapter book graphic novel about mole and vole setting out on expeditions to find all the things in their yard and the world around them. And it's full of activities for kids to do at home, including a nature journal. It's just a really wonderful way to get your kids outside and also exploit the the desire to read a graphic novel.
And that's great for kids who might have a backyard to explore, but if they don't, we love A Cricket in Times Square. A lot of parents, grandparents, are going to recognize this title. It's the Newbery Honor Book by George Selden, originally published in 1960. Tell us about this new version.
So it has a new foreword, which is by Stacy Lee, but it's a classic story of Tucker, who's very streetwise. He's a city mouse, and he just thinks he knows all the ins and outs of everything. And then poor Chester, who's a country cricket from Connecticut, who finds himself in Times Square. There, it's full of adventure, friendships. It's a wonderful book, especially for beginning readers. It's one of those books that really will bind adults and children together, and it's just a wonderful classic tale that anyone can appreciate.
Touch on a book or two for middle grade readers. We like Dan Pablocki's Tales to Keep You Up at Night.
It's the truth. The title tells the truth. If you are trying to get your child to read, give them this book and a flashlight, and they will stay up all night long reading this book. It's about this girl named Amelia who finds a handwritten note in her grandmother's attic that says, "Do not read this book." So, of course, what is she going to do? She's going to read the book. And all of the creepy things she finds out that have been happening around her town are not just stories. They actually begin to happen with Amelia. And your kid will not be able to put it down.
Oh, what a great book to take on vacation or send with a kid if they're lucky enough to go away to camp.
Where
you're reading by flashlight all night anyway.
Yes.
How about one more?
Well, I like Gaia, Goddess of Earth by Imogene Greenberg, because I remember being so overwhelmed with Greek mythology when I was in middle school. And every kid I knew just fell under the spell of Greek mythology. And this is a wonderful book. We follow Gaia as she creates the world. And of course, you know, a god takes credit for her hard work. And it's just the most amazing new take on Greek mythology. And it's something that kids get obsessed with naturally. So I love this book.
Excellent. How much influence do parents and adults in an extended circle, you know, aunts and uncles, have on kids when it comes to books?
I may get in trouble for saying this, but I'll say pretty much zero. That's what's so great about it, in a way, because once kids start reading, they really develop their own tastes. And maybe you don't like the jokes in a certain book, but a kid is going to figure out what they like. So I wouldn't get too hung up on trying to have a heavy message in the books that kids are reading or make it too academically inclined over the summer. The goal is to keep them reading over the summer. So let them have fun with it.
Juanita Giles, Executive Director of the Virginia Kids Book Festival, will have her whole list for summer book recommendations for kids at hereandnow.org. Juanita, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you for having me, Robin.
All right, enough with the kids. Are you looking for a book yourself to read this summer? Well, you might want to check out the new NPR Books We Love. It's a roundup of the most notable books of the year to date. And here to talk about it, Andrew Limbong, Culture Desk reporter and host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, Scott.
So usually in the summer, I gather you do a reader's poll, but now you pulled the NPR staffers for their favorite books. Is that right?
Yeah. So we do this thing. It's usually a year-end project where we hit up all of our book critics, as well as producers, reporters, hosts, interns, and, you know, more to check in on what books they're sort of vibing with for the year. And we sort them out by different tags, not just the usual sort of like fiction and nonfiction, but books for art lovers or book club ideas or seriously great writing, right? And, you know, it is a thing that we do at the end of the year usually, but it's a lot of books at the end of the year. So, you know, we thought we'd compile a sort of mid-year check-in to get people in the swing of summer reading.
Well, I'm always looking for the next book club recommendation. So what was the hot book among NPR staff?
So the book that got shouted out the most was The Paris Apartment. It's by Lucy Foley, who is an absolute pro at writing mystery whodunits. And, you know, her latest book is about this woman named Jess who goes to live with her brother in Paris after she loses her job. But by the time she gets there, he's missing. And, you know, like any other good mystery, she finds out all kinds of things about him as she tries to crack the case. The editor who recommended it, Ariel Redig, called it a dark and moody escape, if that's the kind of thing you're looking for.
Yeah, I'm often looking for that. Okay, another pick from the staff you want to talk about?
Yeah, for something a little lighter, Elaine Shea Chow's novel Disorientation got a lot of love from our staff. It's a debut novel, and it's a satire that takes place in the world of academia. It's about a young PhD.
I love it somehow already.
Yeah, so it centers on a young PhD student who's named Ingrid, and she, you know, she spends years working on her dissertation about this Chinese poet that Ingrid herself isn't so hot on. But as she's like researching, she finds, you know, something out about the poet that could completely shake up her East Asian studies department at the school. But like the book deals with like power and Orientalism and sexual politics and also the kind of campus uproars we hear about all the time. But it's done in kind of a zany and off the wall way.
Yeah, no, I can already think of my academic friend who I want to recommend this to. Okay, finally, Andrew, how about you? What book stood out to you?
So on my to-read list now, because of the Books We Love project, is this book called Chilean Poet by Alejandro Zambra. Leah Danella, who's an editor on the Code Switch podcast, wrote the blurb for that book, and it really stood out to me. She called it a quote, excruciating portrait of what it means to be a cliche at different stages in your life. You know what I mean? So either like a sad teenager or an absent dad you know, Chilean poet. And it's a book about an aspiring poet and, you know, is apparently filled with intentionally bad poetry. And, you know, I was an English major, right? And I've written some pretty bad poetry and I'm kind of looking forward to a cringing my way through the book.
Cringing his way through the book is Andrew Limbong, host of the NPR Book of the Day podcast and reporter on the Culture Desk. And you can find a link to the list at hereandnow.org. Andrew, thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
During the pandemic, workers have gained a lot of power, and some are using that new power to unionize workplaces. And sometimes just the threat of a union is enough to get bosses to act. That's what happened at one local coffee business in Wisconsin. NPR's Andrea Hsu takes us there.
All righty, I've got that medium cappuccino all set.
I've come to Stone Creek Coffee's Factory Cafe. It's one of eight Stone Creek locations around the Milwaukee area. Eric Resch is walking me around the 130-year-old building, which also houses their roastery, their bakery, and their training lab.
We'll be teaching latte art, how to pull espresso. This is where we also have parties and throwdowns and other events at the factory.
Resch founded this business almost 30 years ago after working as a barista and a manager at Starbucks. From the start, he'd embraced the idea that the business has an obligation to care for those around it. Everyone from the farmers who grow the beans to the staff who brew the coffee. He saw himself as a boss who was accessible, someone who listened and learned. But a few years ago, something happened that shattered that view. It started with a notice from the Teamsters.
I think it actually came in the mail as a certified letter.
Followed up by an email. Turns out his staff at Stone Creek Coffee had been organizing, and they wanted Resch to voluntarily recognize a union. His initial reaction?
Surprised, like, oh, wow, okay, this is something I've never encountered before.
This was 2.5 years before unionizing took off at Starbucks. But elsewhere in the service industry, workers were speaking out. Kelly Lutz, one of his baristas, had taken note of fast food workers demanding $15 an hour. It made her reflect on her own wage at the time, $8.25 an hour before tips.
What I make can't even pay for, like, two lattes.
The math didn't add up for her when she and the other baristas were the ones enduring so much stress.
Someone calls in sick, or there's a line out the door, or the air conditioning isn't working, or whatever else. Like, we can't go to the bathroom. All of that stuff, like, that all adds up over time.
Lutz had grumbled about some of these things, but not to Eric Resch.
I didn't even meet him until a petition was put through.
It was a humbling moment for Resch. He thought he had created systems for workers to speak up. Now he realized they were broken. A week after receiving the Teamsters letter, Resch began holding workshops.
I stood before my team. I mean, I remember it very clearly. And I said, talk to me. What is it that I missed? What is it that you all are asking for?
He wanted a chance to make things right without a union, but it was fraught. He said no to voluntary recognition of the union and brought in a couple lawyers to help him through the next steps. Suddenly, he was being called a union buster. His workshops were captive audience meetings. It was an emotionally draining time for him, but he came out of it with a clear understanding that some workers felt unheard. They couldn't get their ideas and perspectives across.
There were not enough ways for that to be done. Organizing as a union was certainly a way to do it, but there are certainly other ways to come at the problem.
He was relieved that a majority of his employees agreed. The staff rejected the union, allowing Resch to take a deep breath and reflect.
I learned a lot. I changed the company a lot.
Among the changes, he created two traveling positions, baristas who can go cover in any cafe when someone calls out. He started putting out schedules 3 weeks in advance instead of 1 week in advance. And he now meets with an employee council every 2 months. They do something called hot or not.
What's hot? I love this drink. I love that new geisha coffee. What's not? It's not hot when we have to fill a catering box of coffee and it spills.
Someone suggested a funnel would help. Easy solution to a problem he may have been oblivious to in the past. Resch has also come to see the value of sharing what he's dealing with too, including financial uncertainty. There were many years, he says, when Stone Creek only broke even, and others when they barely survived.
I can understand why someone might think, oh wow, they can afford to build a store, but they may not realize that we borrowed money to build the store.
Now he opens the company's books to any staff member who asks. I ask him, in a way, was the union drive good for Stone Creek?
I mean, that's too simple. It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's a thing that we learned from.
That made them stronger and a better employer. Of course, for some, it may still not be enough. To which Resch would say, you know, everyone has a choice.
I have a choice to run and own this company, and I will continue to do it as long as I love it and I'm healthy. And they have a choice whether this is a good environment for them to work in.
After Stone Creek's union election, Kelly Lutz, the barista who launched it all, made her choice. She quit her job and found a new calling. She's now a certified nursing assistant and a union shop steward at a hospital. Her union aspirations carry on. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Milwaukee.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.